In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
You walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Once upon a time, there was a New York City councilman who introduced a bill to end the process of treating the public water supply with fluoride, a pollutant from the aluminum and fertilizer industry. But alas, a pro-fluoridation view prevailed, and the councilman's bill was put aside despite the proven long-term human health effects of consuming fluoridated water, such as reduced intelligence, bone frailty, dental fluorosis, and cancer. One public radio outlet at the time described the bill this way, quote, "A city council member wants New Yorkers to brush their teeth and not rely on the public water system to provide fluoride for healthy teeth." First, no one wanted New Yorkers to brush their teeth, and second, fluoridated water doesn't provide for healthy teeth. We would expect more from public radio, such as telling us about the studies that nearly 50% of the daily fluoride intake accumulates in the bone, and 41% of children between 12 and 14 have some form of dental fluorosis. I might suggest that treating the entire populace for dental health via public water supply is a similar imposition to the faulted logic of bathing entire communities with 5G wireless millimeter radio waves. Where is the freedom of choice? Children and the elderly are disproportionately affected by fluoride and radiation, both cumulative in the body. According to fluoridealert.org, 97% of Western Europe has rejected water fluoridation, and communities worldwide are voting to remove fluoride from their public water supply. Since 2010, more than 240 communities have rejected it, including Calgary, Alberta, Windsor, Ontario, Portland, Oregon, Wichita, Kansas, and Bucks County, Pennsylvania. We welcome back Dr. Paul Connett to talk about this underreported positive change. His work in exposing fluoride as a deadly industrial waste, and also what's going on with a recent legal challenge to the EPA. Dr. Paul Connett is Professor Emeritus in Environmental Chemistry at St. Lawrence University in Canton, New York. For the past 30 years, Dr. Connett has put his scientific knowledge to work by freely helping communities worldwide to understand the science of controversial issues such as incineration and fluoridation. He's the director of the Fluoride Action Network and author of the book, The Case Against Fluoride, How Hazardous Waste Ended Up in Our Drinking Water and the Bad Science and Powerful Politics That Keep It There. He's also the author of The Zero Waste Solution, Untrashing the Planet, One Community at a Time. Dr. Paul Connett, welcome to Another News.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, Dr. Connett, would you tell listeners, please, about the recent studies indicating how fluoride can damage the fetal and infant brain, lower IQ, and increase the symptoms of ADHD?
Indeed. The bombshell fell, Jeff, September the 19th, 2017. There was a study published. It was 12 years in the making. It was a multi-million dollar study, and it was financed by the NIH, National Institute of Health, and the NIEHS, the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. And it involved scientists from many Canadian and American and Mexican universities. And basically, it was the first study to show that the fetus exposed during pregnancy is the most susceptible to fluoride's damage to the brain. And the way they established this was they measured the fluoride levels in the mother's urine. Now, let me just back off a second and explain why that's significant. The level of fluoride in the urine is independent of the source. Whatever source is the source of the fluoride, whether it's from water or food or from toothpaste, it doesn't matter. The level of fluoride in the urine gives you an indication of how much the pregnant woman has been exposed to fluoride. So they measured that in about 300 pregnant women in Mexico City, and then they measured the IQ of their children at the age of 4 and then again between 6 and 12. And in both cases, there was a significant drop in IQ of those children. I think for each 1 milligram per liter increased concentration in the urine, there was a 4 to 6 IQ point drop. And that is extremely significant because the levels at which we're talking about, that range of 1 milligram per liter, is easily experienced by pregnant women in the United States. And also, a study that came out 1 year later showed in Canada that the average urine levels of pregnant women in Canada, measured in several different cities, was almost identical to the urine levels which had caused this lowering of IQ in the Mexican City women.
Was that a government-funded taxpayer study?
Oh, absolutely. This was funded by the NIEHS, the NIH, and even the EPA. Now, I'm not sure the motivation of why they suddenly, having neglected to study this for many, many years, that they should suddenly turn around and put money into this 12, or it would have been 15 years ago now. But it was a bombshell because even though, let me give you the up-to-date figures, there have now been 64 IQ studies, human studies, in which the lowering of IQ has been investigated as a function of fluoride. Most of these have been done in China, some in India, Iran, and Mexico. 64. And only 8 of those have not shown a reduction, a significant reduction in IQ. But hitherto, the promoters of fluoridation have always said, oh, well, these studies are done in China. Oh, there are high levels of fluoride. There's fluoride pollution, blah, blah, blah. Every excuse under the sun why promoters of fluoridation would not consider these studies done in China and other countries were relevant, significant, and so on, even though the drops in IQ were pretty high. There was, in fact, a meta-analysis published in 2012 by a team from Harvard, which included Philippe Grandjean, who's the world's expert on the neurotoxicity of mercury. They did a study. They looked at 27 of these IQ studies, 25 from China and 2 from Iran. And they found the consistency was remarkable. 26 out of those 27 studies showed a lowering of IQ. 26 out of 27. Even though these studies were done over a period of 21 years, done in 2 different countries, and done in many different geographical locations in China, and done by different research teams, this consistency was remarkable. But even so, the promoters of fluoridation just went on their merry way. But now, all those arguments about weak methodologies done in China, can't trust the Chinese, all of these things are now out of the window. But then the next argument, by and large, I should say the mainstream media did not take much attention of that. We did our best on our webpage, fluoridealert.org, to draw attention to what we consider to be the most important IQ study performed up to that point. But, oh, it was only one study. Only one study. Well, run the clock forward 2 years. In 2019, it was done in Mexico, so that was not relevant to the United States, according to the ADA. Never mind that, as I said, they measured the fluoride levels in the urine, which made it comparable, useful to compare with any other country. It was independent of the nature of the source. Anyway, in 2019, there was a study published by Green, and this got major media attention. Not the New York Times, they've continued to ignore this issue, but in most of the mainstream media around the world, because it was published in JAMA Pediatrics, which is the leading journal of pediatrics in the world. And they went to enormous trouble to make sure that this was not just peer-reviewed by the usual number. They did it several times, peer review, and they double-checked the statistical analysis. And when they published the paper, they knew that they were going to come under fire. So they had an editorial from David Bellinger, who again is one of the world's leading neurotoxicologists, who teaches at Harvard and a couple of other institutions, I think. And he wrote an editorial saying the reduction in IQ in this study is as on the same par as the reduction from lead, which is an extraordinary, and he's one of the experts on lead and neurotoxicity. And also, to just to add to it, there was an editorial, written editorial, explaining to what lengths the journal had gone to before they published this, and a podcast from the editor of JAMA in general and JAMA Pediatrics. So I think it was 20 minutes they were talking to each other about this, how they were both extremely shocked that they both believed that there was no problem with fluoridation, that the people opposed to fluoridation were, you know, the usual stuff, crazy people. They were shocked by these findings, these very serious findings. And in the interview, they even one of them recommended that if his wife was pregnant, he would advise her not to be drinking fluoridated water.
It seems that in addition to not wanting to put their jobs in jeopardy, those in professional jobs such as toxicology may inadvertently trust that the ADA or Health Canada or other organizations did proper research and assume the data is correct without checking through it and consider challengers of water fluoridation paranoid.
Yeah, absolutely. They clearly had not been keeping up with the literature on this issue. There was another NIH-funded study, NIEHS-funded study. Again, it was meticulously carried out with controlling for all the variables. The statistical analysis was excellent. It essentially reproduced the Bashash study from 2017, the Mexico City study, but this study was done in Canada. But it didn't end there. That was 2019. Then in 2020, we've had another bombshell. Those two studies I referred to were exposure during pregnancy. We now have a study from Canada again. This is Till and co-workers, and the same team as Green from the JAMA Pediatric Study. And they have found bottle-fed babies in fluoridated communities have significantly lowering of IQ compared to bottle-fed babies in non-fluoridated communities. In other words, the difference being that in a fluoridated community, you can assume that the formula was made up with fluoridated tap water, and in the non-fluoridated communities, it wouldn't have been. A 9 IQ point difference. So again, that was another bombshell. But again, it's not over. In terms of cognitive effects, the Bashash study that was published in 2017, using the same cohort of mother offspring pairs, I should have mentioned that before, that we're looking at pairs, data pairs. You look at the mother and you look at the offspring. In each case, you've got one data point for a mother offspring pair. They did the same thing with the symptoms of ADHD, and they found an increased number of symptoms in as the level of fluoride exposure in the pregnant women went up as measured in their urine. So a relationship with ADHD, and again, that has been reproduced in even more stark form, again in Canada. Study published by Riddle and others in 2019 showed that the prevalence of ADHD is 300% higher in fluoridated communities in Canada than non-fluoridated communities in Canada. So the science at this point is overwhelming. But it gets even stronger because in 2016, our organization, the Fluoride Action Network, asked the National Toxicology Program to do a systematic review of fluoride's neurotoxicity, which they did, and they published their findings late last year. And having looked at all the human and the animal studies, they said it's a presumed neurotoxicant for human beings, that fluoride is a presumed neurotoxicant. And that is the second, the only higher classification that they could have come to was known neurotoxicant. But based upon the studies now, it's presumed to be a neurotoxic substance. So here we, and that is a draft review, and right now it's being reviewed by the National Academy of Sciences, and we are expecting the National Academy of Sciences review of this draft review by the NTP to come out any day. But meanwhile, we have these devastating studies on the scientific level, but we have equally devastating on the political level, that the ADA is making no difference to them. They're still promoting fluoridation. They have the goal to celebrate the 75th anniversary of fluoridation in Grand Rapids a few days ago. They're still celebrating fluoridation when they should be incredibly embarrassed that they have been damaging the brains of American children for 75 years. And as far as the health departments are concerned, even the agencies that paid for these studies are not taking the advice of the JAMA pediatrics editors and warning pregnant women not to be drinking fluoridated water during pregnancy and not warning parents to use non-fluoridated tap water to make up formula for their babies. I just find this reprehensible, unconscionable. I mean, these agencies are set up to protect the public health. We're talking about the National Institute of Health. We're talking about the Environmental Protection Agency. We're talking about the Food and Drug Administration. Not one of them are issuing warnings as a result of not only these studies, but the other 58 studies or whatever there are showing a relationship with lowered IQ. You could argue on the precautionary principle, there's enough science on the table to warrant an immediate moratorium on this practice. But no, sadly for them, this practice and defending this practice to the very end is more important to them than protecting the health of the American people. As I say, that is reprehensible. And I am just waiting for some doctors to speak out on this. I mean, this policy now is such a violation of the Hippocratic Oath. First, do no harm.
What do you hear from doctors who know the science on both sides and actually look through the science and the studies that you had brought forward and compared them with what science exists to show water fluoridation actually prevents tooth decay? When you talk with an honest doctor or professional, what would the response be?
Well, I'm afraid the answer is very depressing. There are very few doctors, very few people that head up professional bodies like the American Medical Association, the U.S. Public Health Association. Many of these bodies, again, these professional bodies that are in the health field, they just do not keep up with the literature. They're not reading the literature. Even those that do are making excuses, trying to find, to nitpick the methodology when it's pretty robust. It's extraordinary. So unfortunately, that is the biggest crime, that most doctors are very busy in their practices. They don't have time to keep up with all the literature. But when you have professional bodies that have professional staff, those staff should be right on top of this literature, right on top of this literature. And what about the pediatricians? Surely they read the Journal of the American Medical Association, Pediatrics Journal? If they don't, they're not being very professional. But because this study was made freely available by the journal before it was published, the proponents of fluoridation were already ready, and they had rounded up a few scientists who none of them were neurotoxicologists. None of them were specialists in fluoride, but they came in with attacks on the methodology. It really orchestrated by the promoters of fluoridation. And that helped to nullify, to a certain extent, what was going on. But now, any doctor that goes to our webpage, fluoridealert.org, we've made all the studies available. We've linked to every single IQ study, including the ones which didn't find an effect. And all these studies can be viewed on our revolving masthead with media coverage and so on. Everything is put into context. And it's very depressing that we hear from very few doctors. We have one or two doctors who work with us, and of course they're appalled that this continues. And we have some dentists who are also appalled by this practice, but not enough to shake up the establishment yet.
Dr. Connett, would you talk about the 1999 CDC study that concluded fluoride efficacy for tooth decay prevention as topical only and not internal treatment?
Well, yes, I will. This paper in 1999 was written just by two people from the CDC. One was an economist and one was a dentist whose only research up to that point was smokeless tobacco. But they wrote this paper which was to buttress the notion that fluoridation, according to the CDC Oral Health Division, was one of the top 10 public health achievements of the 20th century. Absolute nonsense, of course, but it has been a real winner for them. I mean, it's been quoted nearly every day by editors, journalists, health officials all over the world. It's hardly a day goes by that somebody doesn't quote this. The CDC says that fluoridation is one of the top 10 public health achievements of the 20th century. It is actually the biggest public health deception of the 20th century. However, they did do one thing right in this study. They conceded that even though hitherto most people had believed that in order to get the benefits of fluoride, a baby needed to get exposed to it before their teeth had erupted. So that's why doctors were giving pills, fluoride tablets to pregnant women, and why people were encouraged to give the baby fluoride before their teeth had erupted. But then in 1999, the CDC conceded that based upon the overwhelming number of studies in the literature, that the predominant, let's be clear about this, the predominant benefit of fluoride, they said, is topical. Most of the benefit accrues after the teeth have erupted into the mouth. In other words, any rational person reading that would have said, well, if it's topical benefit, then brush fluoride on your teeth and spit it out, maximize the benefit to the teeth, and minimize the exposure to all the rest of the tissues. Of course, the dentist at that point didn't worry about exposure to the rest of the tissues because the only thing that they thought was a problem was dental fluorosis, a mottling of the enamel, which in turn they considered just to be a cosmetic effect. But now, of course, it becomes doubly important that we take notice of the fact that if the benefit is largely topical, then for goodness sake, avoid swallowing it, and particularly pregnant women, and particularly for infants, now that the science is showing this relationship between lowered IQ and increased symptoms, prevalence of ADHD. It just defies common sense that they should continue to try to maintain that the benefit to teeth is somehow more significant than the damage to the brain.
We should mention those 1 gallon jugs in supermarkets of distilled nursery water for babies with added fluoride. What are your thoughts on those continuing to be in supermarkets?
It's absolutely shocking, and it shows the huge gap, this huge gap between what we know, what diligent people know from the scientific literature, and public health policy and public health advice as practiced by our health departments at every level and by the professional bodies. There's no intercession there. There's no watchdog. Where's the Food and Drug Administration jumping in here? The Food and Drug Administration has never, never investigated the toxic effects of ingesting fluoride. Never. The Food and Drug Administration, and in fact, their position on fluoride's ingestion, is that it's an unapproved drug. That literally, the FDA is standing by while an unapproved drug is being deliberately added to the drinking water, which should have been a no-no before this science that I've been talking about. But now that the science is coming out, you would think that they would be jumping into action. But it's just not happening because it's a sacred cow and everybody is scared stiff of upsetting the apple cart for all those prestigious people that have made their careers out of promoting this one of the top 10 public health achievements of the 20th century, according to the Oral Health Division of the CDC. It's a sacred cow.
You know, I recently bought a good fluoride filter for the shower. Previously, I had a regular filter, but using the fluoride filter, you can actually feel a rejuvenation after taking a shower, something that I recall years ago. Would you talk about taking a shower in the federal recommended optimal level of 0.7 parts per million fluoridated water and how that might also immediately affect the mental and emotional state?
We don't know. The science has not been done. Probably, Jeff, your experience is as close to the science that we have on this thing. The science should be relatively easy to do, and if we had responsible health agencies, they would have done it, and that would be simply to put someone in a bath and extract blood from them at regular intervals and see if the fluoride levels increase in their blood. And if it does, then you have a problem. My gut feeling is that, people have hot baths and put Epsom salts and the warm water opens the pores and allows the salts, these water-soluble minerals, to go into your body and you get some health effects from it. Whether that works or not, I don't know. But that's my gut feeling, that it's a very reasonable supposition that soaking in a hot bath and even in the short duration of a shower, you could get some fluoride going into your bloodstream. And again, there are people out there that are super sensitive when they bathe, when they have a shower in a fluoridated community. They come out in big red blotches on their backs, under their arms, and so on. They've taken photographs of it. When they finally go to doctors for several years, and the doctors treat them with tablets and ointments and everything else, nothing works. And then someone asks them, well, is your water fluoridated? And they say, oh, I don't know. They check, and sure enough, it is fluoridated. And then when they take a shower in a non-fluoridated water, they don't get these symptoms. So this is pretty convincing to them, and perhaps to you, but no health agency in the world, in the small fluoridating world, in Australia, New Zealand, Ireland, parts of the UK, parts of Spain, Canada and the United States, Malaysia and Singapore, and Hong Kong, none of the health agencies in those countries have ever been responsible enough to check out super sensitive to fluoride and come up with symptoms which are reversed when they remove the source of fluoride. Again, not very responsible.
Dr. Connett, the Toxic Substances Control Act, TSCA, authorizes the EPA to prohibit, quote, particular use of a chemical that presents an unreasonable risk to the general public or susceptible subpopulations, TSCA gives EPA the authority to prohibit drinking water additives. Would you tell listeners, please, about the TSCA-based lawsuit against the EPA?
Yes, but first let me give you some background. I'd always hoped that one of our three kids would grow up and become an activist and help us. And I had no idea that one of them, our youngest, would not only grow up to become an activist, but would actually help us on the fluoridation issue. And it turned out to be better than us, as my wife and I, better than us as activists, better than us at researching, writing, talking, obviously technology, video making, you name it. And he ran our Fluoride Action Network from 2000 to 2008, including our webpage, and he got together the largest health database in the world on the health effects of fluoride. It was ahead of everybody else, including governments. And he did that from 2000 to 2008. And then he said, now I'm going to become a lawyer. And he became a lawyer. And he did very well. And he then joined a tort law firm in Los Angeles. And then in 2016, and he later got the support of his law firm, but before that, on behalf of FAN, he took a petition to the EPA under this Toxic Substances Control Act. Any individual organization can petition the EPA on that. And the EPA had 90 days to respond to this petition, and it was on neurotoxicity. But note the date, 2016. All that science I told you about has come out since 2016. So we thought our case, our petition, was pretty strong in 2016. But since then, our case has become incredibly strong. So we petitioned the EPA to use this provision, which gave them the right to ban the use of specific uses of toxic substances if they posed a threat to the general population or even subsets of the population. And we said the neurotoxicity of fluoride is such a threat. Well, the EPA had 90 days to respond to that, and they denied our petition. But they made a huge strategic mistake. Rather than denying it on jurisdictional grounds, I think they might have had a stronger case if they'd said, oh, we should send this to the Division of Water, and it should be dealt under the Safe Drinking Water Act, which would have been disastrous for us because those guys have been in the pocket of the National Institute of Health and the promoters of fluoridation for many, many, many years. So that would have been useless. But they didn't. They rejected our petition on scientific grounds. In other words, they disagreed with us about the neurotoxicity of fluoride, which then enabled us to reject, in other words, appeal this petition and take it to a federal law judge, which we've done. It's now in federal court, and we've won several motions up to this point, and the case is going to court April the 20th. It will be a two-week case. We get 4 days in the first week. The EPA gets 4 days in the second week, but starting in April the 20th of this year, 2020. And with all these new studies coming out, including studies funded by the EPA themselves and studies funded by the NIH that promotes fluoridation, you know, the NIH is the parent body for the CDC and so on, and we got an NTP review of the neurotoxicity, I think we've got an incredibly strong case. Already, we've got some of the world's leading experts on this issue. Howard Hugh, who was the lead author of the Bashar study, the 2017 Mexico City study, Bruce Lamphere, a very well-known expert, a go-to expert for the authorities on lead neurotoxicity. He was part of the Green and Till studies. We have Philippe Grandjean, another great expert in neurotoxicity. So we got some of the world's leading neurotoxicologists on our side, And as far as benefits are concerned, we've got one of the leading world's leading experts on topical versus systemic benefits, Ole Fjerdrof from Denmark. So we got a wonderful lineup of experts. And the EPA, they don't have their own experts. They've had to go to a firm, and I forgot the name of the firm, but they are the henchmen for the chemical industry. The chemical industry, when they want to show that dioxin is safe enough to put on your cornflakes, goes to this consulting agency, and that's who the EPA are using. So we're up against industry shills, paid-for-hire industry experts who will say that everything is safe, and now they're saying that fluoride is safe for the infant brain. So we got a very strong case. So I think the days of fluoridation are numbered. We know it's not necessarily going to be easy. We could win this lawsuit in April, or you know, maybe it'd take a couple of months for the judge to rule. Then the EPA will do its usual thing of trying to appeal and then try to spin it out for several years. But I think the message will go around the world to citizens in other countries like New Zealand and Australia and England and Canada, and they will get the political message long before the EPA finally rules that you shouldn't add this stuff to the water. The fact that a federal law judge has ruled, on top of everything else, that this is with that we've won our case, will have significant effects on this practice. So I think we're looking at the end of fluoridation within, say, 3 years worldwide, which has always been my dream.
Quick question about this. Where will the lawsuit take place?
It's in San Francisco. The judge is very bright. He knows the issue. He's asked incredibly good questions in all the motions. The EPA has tried to dismiss the motion, to dismiss the case twice and failed. The judge seems to be insistent that this go forward. Well, he is insistent that it goes forward. So we're very pleased on that front, too. And this, Jeff, after 24 years of waiting, this is the first time that this issue is going to get a judge to be heard, that both sides are going to be heard, that the experts under oath are going to be heard by an independent body, not the government ruling on its own practices, which is what's happened every time. You appeal to the CDC, oh, it's fine. You appeal to the FDA, oh, it's fine. You appeal to the EPA. So they have been their own judge and jury. The federal agencies that promote and support this practice have been the judge and jury whenever the issue has been raised and it reaches a significant level. Their authority has trumped things, and it certainly worked with the media. The media always goes, the mainstream media always goes first to the regulatory bodies in charge, and they take their word for gospel as opposed to independent scientists like myself.
This is really great news, and on fluoridealert.org, you can learn a lot about this particular case, and the timeline is set up on this case, and there's great videos of your son discussing and explaining this lawsuit. So I definitely look forward to it. And would you encourage listeners of this interview to be there in support?
Yes, that, Jeff, I think would be terrific. You know, if people have the wherewithal to get to the court, the federal court in San Francisco, I think they'll find it absolutely gripping. Again, the date is April 20th is when it begins. And we are actually at the moment considering whether to have a mini conference in San Francisco the weekend between the 2 weeks. So it would be like April 25th, 26th, the Friday, Saturday, maybe the Sunday. Between those 2 weeks, we could have a mini conference. Again, you know, people don't have, maybe a lot of people don't have the time to do this. Maybe people don't have the money to do it. But if they're in the San Francisco area, you know that California has mandatory fluoridation. It's incredible, but true. California is mandatory if you can get independent funding for it. It can't be financed by the local government. So they've got the tobacco money, being used by First Five, I think they're called, or something like that. They're using tobacco money to fund the damaging of the brains of the children. So not only have people been damaged by tobacco, and then the compensation that the tobacco industries are being doled out is now being used to damage the brains of children in California. It's quite sick, really sick. Much more sick if people knew what they were doing, but unfortunately most people are kept obliviously ignorant of this, and thank goodness you've got programs like you and stations like Pacifica that will actually give air to someone like myself and organizations like ours. Oh, and by the way, I should say that our lawsuit is not just us. It's not just the Fluoride Action Network. We have Food and Water Watch involved. We have the IAOMT, that is the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology, IAOMT, which is a group of dentists who realize that there's too many toxic substances being used in dentistry, like mercury and fluoride. They're part of this lawsuit. And then we have individuals part of this lawsuit. We also have Mums Against Fluoridation, another very good group fighting fluoridation. So it isn't just the Fluoride Action Network.
This is amazing. I want to just go back for a minute, Dr. Conant, to Christopher Bryson's book, The Fluoride Deception. He mentions that Gerald Cox, a researcher at the Mellon Institute on fellowship from Alcoa, the Aluminum Company of America, he was the first to suggest adding fluoride to the public water supplies in 1939. And for context, the Mellon Institute in Pittsburgh was the leading defender of asbestos for the asbestos industry. Now, was this suggestion to add fluoride to public water supplies then taken up as a worldwide practice?
Yep. This is extraordinary. And I think Chris Bryson does an absolutely brilliant job of saying that this is two stories, interwoven story. You've got, if you like, a semi-respectable thread, which is the dental community studying dental fluorosis and thinks that there might be the kids that are being overexposed to fluoride and getting dental fluorosis, it may also be reducing tooth decay, and pursued that. The U.S. Public Health Service pursued that strand. But you also had an invested interest from industry. Many industries were producing a lot of fluoride pollution. And you know, 1939, when Gerald Cox proposes this, this is 6 years before the first trial began in 1945 to test this thesis on the dental level in Grand Rapids, Michigan. So this is 6 years before there was much traction from the dental community and the U.S. Public Health Service. And also the Mellon Institute. The Mellons were very much involved in Alcoa, and one of the industries that puts out a huge amount of fluoride pollution is the aluminum industry. They use calcium fluoride to lower the melting point of the alumina, which is dissolved in cryolite, which is Na3AlF6. So there's a lot of fluoride involved in aluminium extraction. A lot of fluoride pollution goes up the stacks, both as particles and as gases, hydrogen fluoride, etc. And in the late 1930s, and certainly subsequent to that, there were many lawsuits from farmers whose cattle and vegetation crops were being damaged by the emissions from aluminum plants. And many others, steelworks, zinc smelters, the metallurgical industries use calcium fluoride as a flux. Then you have the phosphate fertilizer industry, which was putting out a lot of fluoride. So there were lots of American industries that were scared of tougher regulations, air emissions, and water levels. Gerald Cox's words, when he published that paper in 1939, he said words to the effect you know, this notion that we should have tougher water standards for fluoride needs to be reassessed. This was the point when they were talking about lowering the level of acceptable level of fluoride in the drinking water from one part per million down to 0.1. That's what they were concerned about. They were concerned about that lowering of the standard, or the making it more severe, the standard. And so Gerald Cox was working on behalf of industry to make sure that that didn't happen by pursuing the benefits of fluoride as opposed to its toxic effects, which, of course, is a thread that's continued for about 80 years since that point. So now that's one concern then, was the levels might be imposed upon the industry for air emission levels and then water effluent levels. The other thing was a concern about what they were doing to their workers. Alcoa was very concerned about the health of their own workers. Their health was being compromised by working in those pot lines where they were exposed to a hell of a lot of fluoride. So those were the industrial concerns. And there was a very interesting, you know, 31, that three separate researchers, a team in Morocco, I think it was, a team in Texas, and a team in Bauxite, Arkansas, separately determined that the substance in the drinking water that was causing this condition called dental fluorosis was fluoride. That was in 1931. I think I got my year right. And one of those researchers was H.V. Churchill, who was the chief chemist of Alcoa. He determined in the city of Bauxite, you can know where that word comes from, Bauxite, determined that fluoride was causing dental fluorosis. And one of the things, and this is in a footnote, you know, Christopher Bryson's book is two books. There is a narrative, and then there's 100 pages of footnotes. And you can read those footnotes as a separate book. And one of the footnotes is extraordinary. H.V. Churchill, when he discovered this, wrote to or phoned dentists in Messina, New York, which was close to where I used to live, Messina, New York, which had an Alcoa smelter. And he wanted to know if there were any cases of dental fluorosis in Messina and what the levels were of fluoride in the drinking water. And he was told, yes, there were cases of dental fluorosis in Messina, and no, there wasn't much fluoride in the drinking water. Now, just imagine now, you're in the position of Churchill in Alcoa, who said, oh my God, we've now got this telltale symptom of exposure to fluoride, namely dental fluorosis. And we also know from industrial records that fluoride is causing health problems, damage to the bones and other things. And he must have gone, oh my God, if anywhere people develop dental fluorosis, they're going to say, where is this fluoride coming from? Well, the first thing they do is to analyze the water to see if there's natural fluoride in the water. And if they drew a blank on that, they would say, well, where is there a source of fluoride? And if they looked around and found Alcoa manufacturing aluminium in their area, oh my goodness, there could be one hell of a lawsuit there. So the last thing you wanted to know is that, A, that any industry does not want to know that there's a simple, visible biomarker of exposure to fluoride and a litany of health effects associated with this pollutant, because that is the formula for lawsuits. And another book which has received less attention is a book by Geoffrey Smith in Australia. And Geoffrey was English, he was a dentist, but he also worked for MI5 in England, a remarkable character. And his book He said, in Australia, the first town that was fluoridated in Australia was not Sydney or you know, one of the a big town, or it was this obscure little town in Tasmania called Beaconsfield. And people scratched their head. Why was this the first place in the whole of Australia that experimented with fluoridation? And then he said, well, a few years later, they built an aluminum smelter in the area. So people must have known that this smelter was going in, and in order to protect themselves, put fluoride in the drinking water so that if dental fluorosis accrued in their area, instead of pointing at the aluminum smelter, they would be pointing at the drinking water. So if you want a horrible conspiracy theory, and I don't believe in those things, but if you wanted one, that you could say, when Alcoa realized that dental fluorosis could get them into huge lawsuits, then the object of the exercise for both Alcoa and industry was to give dental fluorosis via the drinking water to as many people as they could, because then you could never point the finger at industry's toxic emissions as being the cause of, A, the dental fluorosis and other things. And I'm not suggesting, well, you know, people can follow that up to see if there's any evidence for that. But the interesting thing is that the percentage of children in the United States that now have dental fluorosis is huge. It was over 40% in 2010, a report from the CDC in 2010, that 40% of American kids now had dental fluorosis. And there are figures which suggest it's gone up since then, but people are quibbling about the latest of these studies. But it's still much, much higher than they ever anticipated.
It seems the smaller municipalities noticed the financial impacts of water fluoridation on their community. And when a percentage of the populace recognizes that, quote, fluoride helps fight tooth decay, is not only a huge lie, but it's hiding the fact that it's poisonous to human health, then action is taken. Dr. Connett, would you talk about your thoughts on communities worldwide removing fluoride treatment from their public water supply?
Yes, that's an important question. We have on our homepage a listing of about 240 odd communities that have removed fluoride over the last, I think, since 2010. It's a lot of communities. Many of them are in New Zealand. Some are in other countries, a lot in Canada. Canada has had significant removals. Calgary, a community of between 1.2 and 1.5 million, has stopped fluoridation. I'm happy to say that one of the co-authors of my book, The Case Against Fluoride, he was instrumental in using our book to help end fluoridation in Calgary. But many other communities in Canada have stopped, and quite a number of communities in the United States. And there's a complete listing there. You know, hats off to the heroes, the local decision makers. You need one or two with a lot of fortitude and a lot of perseverance to actually pull this off, because the moment the ADA hears a whisper that any community is trying to remove fluoridation, they're going to make that as difficult as possible. They're going to flood the decision makers' chambers with their experts claiming it's the best thing since sliced bread, et cetera, et cetera. So it ain't easy. It's going to get easier as more and more people hear about these IQ studies and these brain studies. I don't think that many people would take lightly the notion of deliberately adding fluoride to the drinking water, when even if you wanted fluoride, you've got a method of applying it, namely brushing it on your teeth and spitting it out, which doesn't have the same exposure to the rest of your body and your brain and your baby's brain that putting it in the water has.
When this lawsuit begins in April, I'm sure it's going to get a lot of press and people will be writing about it. Even when you manage to not consume fluoride in your drinking water, food products, pharmaceuticals, bottled water, and beer, including Guinness, contain fluoride. It's also intentionally added to some processed foods. Would you talk more about this, please?
Yes, it is very difficult to avoid fluoride. As you said, if you put it in the drinking water, you have the multiplier effect that it ends up in processed foods and foods and beverages which are made up with tap water. So when you reconcentrate a fruit juice, for example, they use local tap water, then you get fluoride. And same when you're making beer in a fluoridated community or other drinks in a fluoridated community, you get this multiplier effect. Not many drugs, not many fluorinated drugs actually metabolize to free fluoride ion, but when they do, like Cipro, it's very serious. And the quinolones or something, fluoridated quinolones, those are terrible. So avoid Cipro. People's lives have been totally ruined by Cipro, which does metabolize to free fluoride and delivers the fluoride to very sensitive parts of your body.
Well, Dr. Conant, the work that you've done in raising awareness on this issue has created an umbrella of courage for like-minded groups and helped connect communities to start researching fluoride toxicity and rejecting it from their public water supplies. The work can be frustrating, but looking at the list of townships and cities removing fluoride from their public water is a major accomplishment to be part of. And I want to thank you again for being on In Other News.
Thank you, Jeff, very, very much. And before I go, if I can just pay homage to two people. One person I think you know, Phyllis Mullinex, in 1995, published a seminal work on the impact of fluoride on animal behavior. And as a result, she lost her job. And she's not had a job in academia since. But she predicted this loss of IQ in children. She predicted it, and she lost her job doing that. And I think we need to pay homage to Phyllis. There have been about 200 animal studies since then that clearly show that fluoride damages animal brain. And the other person I'd like to pay homage to is our science director, a gentleman called Chris Neurath. He's just done fabulous work, and he's the rock. And any study that comes out, I go to Chris and say, Chris, is this a good study or a bad study? And he knows enough about epidemiology and methodology and statistics to know the difference between a really serious study and a less serious study. And he's the one who steered us through all these IQ studies to the point that we know now that we're on very solid ground. And he right now is helping my son, Michael, every step of the way in our lawsuit.
And definitely would like to have you back on the show after this lawsuit. Dr. Paul Conant, thank you so much again for being on the show.
And thank you, Jeff, very much for having me on.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.